So, thanks for inviting. It was great to interact with people and with old friends and get new friends. And I initially thought that I would be speaking about evolve and resequence. But then there were such terrific presentations by Patrick and Neda and Christian, and there is no way in hell I could have made anything as nice, so I decided, why would I speak about that? I should speak about something else, right? And further, I thought that after listening to a few talks here, including talks on like Ecoli evolution stories, I decided that what we should present for you is at least a little bit of summary of work that was going in the lab on evolution of sexually reproducing simulations. So my student Chris Conover, who was doing this work, he joined me and he's parking a car right now. So if my talk is short enough for him to start and give you some presentation, great, but I will at least like leave him last 10 minutes or so, depending on your questions, so he can introduce the topics and you could have like interactions or whatever over lunch. So that will be about using process-based models and trying to understand genotype-phenotype map on the basis of such models. And the first topic, I will give you a little bit of introduction. So it will be about quantitative generic variation and how I got here. But then I will move to early embryo variation models and try to understand how to use those models to predict what is going on with phenotypic variation. And then in the spirit of this workshop to kind of discuss evolutionary process, I will switch to early embryo evolution simulations on the basis of those process-based models. So this will be about flies. And I would like to acknowledge people who have been doing this work. This work is not super new in the lab, but it is kind of newish in the lab. It started about 4 years ago. And it has been a collaboration with people in St. Petersburg State Polytechnical University. So on top of lab in USC, and you will see Asif Zubair, our collaborator Paul Majorum, graduate student Josh Schiffman, and Asif is also a graduate student. You will see people who are working with Maria Samsonova and me in St. Petersburg. And this is Vitaly Gursky, who has started this work when he was a postdoc in USC for a year or so. And then he extended this work in SPB-SPU. And also graduate student Sasha Chertkova, who is very, very good, and she might be looking for the lab in close future. So, but really, this workshop is a little bit of a... is a little bit of deja vu for me. Because it is all about experimental evolution. And we started to do experimental evolution back in 90. And kind of using principles which are very close to evolve and resequence. In fact, it was my first project that I formulated as a grad student that was like that. My advisors, Lena Pasyukova and Vladimir Gvozdev, they told me, hey, we have that very weird case of adaptive transpositions. Whatever you think about it. We keep some strain of Drosophila, and from time to time, and that strain of Drosophila was selected for 500 generations or so for male, low male mating activity. And we keep that strain, and from time to time, it goes good. And it starts, males start to look happy. Can you tell us what's happening there? And the best hypothesis was that transposable elements are jumping to new positions. Somehow it is making good for males. And they wanted to support or refute that idea. So as a new grad student, I was thinking, how would I do it? Well, I have two isogenic lines, and what they're different by? They're different by transposable element positions, because they jumped between those adaptive transpositions. So I thought, why wouldn't I mix them and let them self-evolve and see how positions of occupation frequencies of transposable elements change? And it might not be evolve and resequence, but it is basically the same idea. You mix your two genotypes and you try to use some molecular markers, and we concluded that, no, in fact, it was not adaptive transpositions. It was just some strange change in heterochromatic region of the second chromosome, which was responsible for the process. But that was my initiation point in 91. Then there was kind of little gap, and then we came back to this topic in 98, when I started to use what we called hitchhiking mapping for Bristol number mapping. And we just thought, hey, might be a hitchhiking mapping has more power than standard QTL mapping, and why wouldn't we try? So we mixed a couple of stocks, Aragon and Canton, and we did replicated selections in 1,000 individuals, and we used transposable elements as markers, and Peter Kittler cooked up very nice maximum likelihood estimators for estimation of selection coefficients, which turned out to be like for 10 genes, something like 0.3 selection coefficient, and that was published in 98. Then there was another big gap, and then we published this story with Larry Harshman that might appeal to some people who have been doing such research reasonably recently. So what we decided to do, it is we wanted to start from founder population from natural chromosomes, but we wanted to rely on sampling linkage disequilibrium. So we just sampled two dozens of chromosomes from natural populations. Again, we knew transposable elements in them, we mixed them, we allowed them to recombine for 50 generations. So 50 generations means about 20 recombination breakpoints per chromosome, so it's okay. So, and then we implemented selection for multi-stress resistance, which is something that Larry Harshman has done. So we did it in 5 reps for experiment, for control. And what I think is cool about this study, it is that we have a good idea what our linkage disequilibrium blocks should be, because we know recombination, how much recombination was happening in this population. But of course, it was in prehistoric times, right? 10 years ago, so there was no Illumina yet. So we had to rely on something, and we relied on expression chips. Do you remember those confounded Illumina expression chips? So,
Affymetrix.
Oh, Affymetrix, right. Thanks, Tom, for correcting. So they were tiny oligos that were designed to interrogate transcripts, but those were oligos of about 25 bases. So we decided, what the heck? Why wouldn't we just use mis-hybridization with those oligos as our markers? Of course, it has huge amount of noise with it. They're very error-prone. So analyzing signals from every oligo is immaterial. But if you see some chunks of the genome which are especially differentiated for frequencies of those oligos, you are saying, gosh, that is my potential selection target. So that was our selection response for ability to survive on high oxygen. So that is selected males, females across 5 reps. That is controls. And this is what we detected with oligos. And of course, it was early days, so we didn't know like what approaches to use, so we decided to be as simple as possible. We just took our markers, which are imaginatively depicted here, those dots, and we permuted their positions along the chromosomes. And we were looking for clumps, right, of significant features, which are differentiated between selected and control lines. So that was our permutation threshold. A clump of 10 significant features within 1 million bases. That was our window size. And that is what we thought was generics underlying our selection response. So it wasn't huge number of genes, it was small number of regions. And Michael, I completely am clueless whether or not those are clumps of significant features or major effect genes. This is all I know, right? And in fact, we specifically our procedure of detection in terms of permuting them along the chromosomes was specifically designed to detect clumps. So you might think about it as clumps, right?
How were you combining the different replicates, the data from the different replicates?
That was just p-value, right?
But I mean, from the different replicates, you have markers for each replicate.
Sincerely, I don't remember. I think that what we did was just simple ANOVA with repos to estimate error. But I can come back to that. Hey, it was 10 years ago, right? Okay. So, but then, what was happening? Oops, sorry. It is that is not really satisfactory. And I think that the topic of this workshop was partially how to move from that general understanding that selection is taking place to specific selection targets. So we were trying to understand how to go about it. And we decided, why wouldn't we add a little bit of biology to that? We have knowledge of what is going on, might be not in multi-stress resistance, but we certainly know some underlying molecular biology or developmental biology of some phenotypes. For example, for body size or for protein sugar triglyceride content, we know what gene regulatory network is involved in deciding whether or not flies are going to be fat or lean, large or small. That is called insulin TOR receptor pathway. And we have all our genetic variations, so we decided, hey, might be, instead of trying to do those selection regimes, we could try to understand how much genetic variation exists in that gene regulatory network and use it somehow to understand what is going on here in terms of genotype-phenotype map. So that was about maybe 10 years ago, at which point Patrick Phillips, who is present here, and thank you very much, and you will have to suffer through next 5 minutes as a result of that advice, coined that term structural equation models. That sounded good to me, so I decided to try to understand what the heck was it and how could I use it here. Because you've been at this workshop for quite some time, let me give you this introduction to structural equation models. So, structural equation models is a tool that is used a lot in psychology and in economics, and it goes like that. So imagine I would be at this workshop for a few months, and I would try to model what is responsible for my hangover when I wake up in the morning, right? And I know that my hangover is probably related to my wine consumption, right? So, and the amount of wine consumption might be related to interactions which I have during the day with respected people who are represented in this room. Patrick, Christian, Ivana, Michael, Neda, Robert, right? So, guys, I interact with you, it affects my adrenaline level. Then sometimes my wife Nina comes to visit me, right? And then that confluence of factors determines my wine consumption, which is predictor for hangover. Of course, to understand how that network is structured and to quantitate it, I would need to get lots of measurements and I would need to understand lots of parameters. First, not only I interact with you, but you interact with each other. So your relative mood is affected by how you interact, which is determined by those covariance coefficients. And there are 15 of them for this model, right? Then my adrenaline level is affected by your mood in different ways for different interactions. I might care for some more and for some less. So that is reflected by those pathway coefficients, which could be affecting me to different degree. And then, of course, not only my adrenaline level is explained by your moods and the influence on me, but it is also affected by environmental variation. For example, there is thunderstorm and I didn't sleep well, so all of that goes in those environmental variation terms. So same goes for wine consumption. I like some and I don't like others. So some part of variance in hangover this model would explain, but some portion of variance would remain unexplained. And that is represented by those error terms. So overall, if you look at this picture, you have 25 exogenous variables that you just assume are not explained by the model. And some endogenous parameters, which I want to estimate, which are those pathway coefficients, right? So I have something like 30 plus 3 dozens of variables. And that is bad news, because for making appropriate statistical estimation, I would need to have something like 5 times more observations. So I would need to make that experiment 150 times, like be here at this workshop for half a year to accumulate enough information how the amount of my hangover is related to your mood states. But this is what structural equation does. And I think that it is a very powerful tool, because if you replace those labels with gene names, this is pretty much how gene regulatory network should work. You have, for example, perturbation in production of some transcript or protein, and it should propagate through the system, and that would result in ultimate deviation of phenotype. Right? Make sense?
Feedback.
Huh?
It could be feedback from one.
Absolutely. Absolutely, 100% correct. They could be feedback. So Chris, who just arrived, thanks for parking, Chris. I hope the car is still safe.
I think so.
He will hopefully end his presentation. They could be feedback. Or they could be, for example, we assume that everything is linear, and gene regulatory networks are profoundly non-linear. But this is okay approximation, right? Because we are speaking about small deviations from steady state. And small deviations from steady state could be simulated probably by linear components. You could make it more complex. You could incorporate feedback loops, you could incorporate non-linearities, then estimation becomes hell, then you need many more observations, and my liver would just not sustain it, right?
Alternative is to just say that it's sort of too complex and you need a simple model altogether.
That is correct. And that was a little bit of tragedy, right? For example, we are running with those structural equation models, and I'm coming to statisticians and saying, hey guys, I have gene regulatory network made out of 10 components. And statisticians are saying, no way in hell, it is too complex to estimate. Then I come to computational biologists and they are saying, you are kidding. Unless I have like 100 genes, it's not even interesting to start. So in any case, you can start from some component of it, and the beauty of it is that you can make a sub-module of that, simple. And you can consider some of those external variables. So pretty much what you can do, you can estimate what you can estimate given amount of number of degrees of freedom. And then you can move on. Questions, comments, concerns?
Are you going to describe the data you used there?
So the data are pretty much the same what Christian has described. You have expression levels across a panel of natural variants. And the panel of natural variants is small deviations and small variants on the implementation of gene regulatory network. I assume that the structure is the same, but pathway coefficients are a little bit different, right? I have hundreds of observations of transcriptome from heads of flies, each of which are replicated 3 times for both virgin and mated flies, for example. Then I assume that those genes are connected through their transcripts, might be directly, might be indirectly. If you wanted to include some latent variables, you can do it very easily. And you fit the structure. And when you do it, what is happening, it is that imagine you compare virgin and mated flies. They are different in transcript levels of huge number of genes. Each of that graph describes variation in a panel of about 100 individuals. So you have tons of generic variation both in virgin and mated. All of those genes, of course, are differentially expressed between them, because that determines metabolic state of the pathway, which is very different between virgin and mated, right? That's okay.
I noticed 3 decimal places. Are they all significant?
Oh, those are not. I apologize for them. I should have cut to the first one.
Precisely. How about the first decimal place? Is it significant?
Okay.
Because, for example, I could just perhaps replace all the things in the column on the left by 0.5.
Okay, so let me give you a little bit longer answers than you want to, but we are in exactly the same place, you and me, because you look at those structures and all those genes show differential expression between flies, right? They show variation. But now, if you look at that pathway coefficient, And those pathway coefficients correspond to that stuff, right? To these guys, to these guys. How genes affect each other. What you now see, and apologies, forget about extra decimal points, is that if you see that in red, it is significantly different from zero. That we can test, because we have replication, right? If you don't see them circled, they are not different between versions and mated. And you see that pretty much nothing is different between versions and mated, which is a good news. It means that you estimated it two times completely independently, and your estimation procedure is reasonably robust, right? But even more important message, while you have tons of genes variant here, while you have all those genes differentially expressed, you can say that only one thing is significant, and this is this path. And this path, when it trickles down and up through loops, this is probably what is responsible for different state of the pathways between two environments. Right?
I'm still a bit lost. What are these numbers exactly? There are...
You can think about as about partial correlation coefficients, right? Okay. It's like you vary the level of expression of that gene, and you observe how that level of expression of that gene covaries with it if you take into account all the rest of the structure of the pathway. You fit all that structure at once. So to me, this is very good news, because it is dramatic simplification of what is happening. You started off from huge variants. You started off from everything being differentially expressed, and you ended up with a hypothesis of what is driving those differences. And the rest of variance-covariance structure is consistent with it. Great, right? And not only can we do it between environments, like version and mated, or disease and healthy, in medical setting. But we also can estimate those structures in recombinant inbred lines between two marker allele states. So for example, if you're interested in testing hypothesis of how your structural equation or how your graph of interacting genes is different between QTL1 and allele 1 and QTL allele 2, you can also do it. And you can, in principle, map those genes which are affecting those path coefficients, which make males, virgin and mated females allocate their resources in different way. Make sense? So that was our like next logical step. And if you liked it, thank Patrick Phillips and pour him some champagne today. And if you hate it, like I will have to pour you vodka, I don't know. But what is missing here? What is missing here is what I kind of started from trying to understand. There are no SNPs here. You know the structure, but how do you incorporate generic information here in terms of what is actually causing those differences? And in 2012, we published little trends in generics paper describing a procedure how we can fit SNPs and structural models together. We haven't done it yet because logistically it is a nightmare. But logically, we can do it, and I will be happy to speak about it under request. So that was kind of move forward, but it was unsatisfactory as a result of SNPs. So we decided to try to do something else and something different. Any questions about this stuff before I move on? Because the next topics will be slightly different. Okay.
Well, so what's your bottom line? Is it a good thing, or it didn't add much in the end? Or?
Oh, I think that it is great stuff, right? Because you can ignore so many like flukes and statistical influences, right? And you can kind of crystallize and try to understand what is going on and test and form testable hypothesis for validation. So I think that it is great, but...
But where's the proof that this is right?
Sorry. Right, I have no proof. What I can say it is that logically it doesn't have faults.
Yeah, but you could have come up with any in the pathway and you would say there is no fault.
Do you want to collaborate on like making confirmation study?
No, I'm just asking.
It's right, yeah. Right.
Well, and how do you answer Christian's question in general? Then the proof would be that you would upregulate a gene and then see how the all the downstream network.
Absolutely.
So be able to make a quantitative prediction based on your
absolutely. And let me tell you what it is doing. So suppose I upregulate this gene, right? Then I can create prediction of what is happening with every gene, or with downstream phenotype which feeds out of that gene regulatory network. And this is something testable, right? So for example, imagine that you are giving somebody a drug to upregulate that gene, and you want to understand the influence on multiple genes of that drug. This is a framework that allows you to do it.
I thought the difference was the effect of TSC1 on the next gene.
That's right. This is that pathway coefficient, right?
So the pathway coefficient, not the expression.
Not the node, right?
So it's something about, it's actually not, it's something you can get just by upregulating.
No, I think that you can, because if you just upregulate it with the same pathway coefficient, you will have different entrance point here, right? So it's the same. But you can also affect pathway coefficient, I assume, as well. Okay, so that is kind of introduction to what was our next thinking. What was helpful for us, it is to have the model of gene regulatory networks, which is represented by the graph. And you look in the developmental biology literature, and pretty much 99% of stuff that you will see there is verbal description of a graph. There are very, very few attempts to formalize it, and some of those with formulas. And some of those attempts, and most successful one, were done with Boris, right? By Boris on like eye development, but some of them were done on early embryo variation model or predicting how embryo should develop. Were done by people who were true pioneers in that and might be not sufficiently recognized. It was Eric Mjolsnes, John Reynitz, and Maria Samsonova collaborating with them. So, let me switch to that topic, and this is what my new phenotype likes, looks. And this is boring, right? This is Drosophila egg. So I will be speaking about processes which are happening in Drosophila egg after its nuclei start to divide. And in fact, it turns out into remarkably cool phenotype right away. Don't know how to lower the light here, or hope you can see it well, okay.
It's actually quite bright.
So what is happening? What is happening, it is that in earlier stages of development, and this is single cycle of development stage 14, you have expression levels of certain genes. In green here is a hunchback, in red it is giant, and in blue it is Eve. And you may recall studies that Marty Kreitman was doing on genetics underlying variation in if stripe 2 expression. So what does it mean, stripe 2? So hunchback is deposited in kind of gradient from anterior to posterior. Disregard that area because like those models usually cover just a fraction of embryo. Then somehow magically those genes interact with each other and they start splitting embryo to more and more rectified domains. So for example, here you can see that if expression is kind of just starting, here it is more visible. Here you have those domains of expression pretty much determined. And by the end of that cycle, you have nice striped embryo from if, and the second one of those stripes is called if stripe 2. So for physicists and for developmental biologists, it was always cool to understand how you start from that not very well defined pattern, and how then you start rectifying it and perfecting it to accomplish such perfect and beautiful outcome, right? So they were building models for that. And some of those models were built to the state when they incorporate sequence information. And this is what I want. I want that sequence information to understand what model will give me. By the way, this is the very first time I'm trying to speak about something like that. So I apologize for confusion. And please ask questions if something remains confusing, okay? And let me give you a warning. If you don't ask questions, I will start asking you questions. So this is if stripe 2. How is it working? So remember we had that hunchback profile in green, which I showed you on the previous picture. And by the way, that is beautiful technology. All of those stripes are multiplexed from single embryo. That is technology called hybridization chain reaction. And this is something that Sveta Surkova developed in my lab over her visits from St. Petersburg. So what mom is doing? Mom is pumping into this egg what is called maternal genes, and one of them is called bicoid. This is gradient of concentration of bicoid from anterior to posterior portion of the embryo. Hunchback is using concentration of bicoid as readout, and when this concentration is appreciable, hunchback is expressed reasonably fully, and then when it is zero, it fast decays. So this is how bicoid affects hunchback. Then hunchback and bicoid, their combination affects expression of giant protein, for example, which is represented in red, along embryo. And when expression levels of both of those genes are in appropriate range, giant expresses. When at the intersection of those genes decaying in expression to zero, there is expression of cripple protein. And if stripe 2, that one, which you saw in the previous slide, is expressed in accordance with the following logical rule. When those two genes are on, but those two genes are off, if 2 is expressing. How is it accomplished? It is accomplished in the following way. There is regulatory region of the gene, if, and it has those cis regulatory modules. And those cis regulatory modules are driving expression of if in specific domains of the embryo. For example, that one drives expression in second stripe. So let's see how it is organized. That like little blue region is now represented here. There are transcription factor binding sites here for cripple, giant, bicoid, hunchback, and some of them are silencing expression, and some of them are enhancing expression. So to stage expression of if, what you have to do, you have binding of activators, hunchback and bicoid. And you should avoid binding of suppressors, which are giant and cripple. So when you have this situation, high expression of hunchback and bicoid, but no giant and cripple, that logical device drives expression of if strike 2.
How do you get the and part? And hunchback and bicoid? Is that something about the bottom right?
So those are different sequences, right? Those are different little binding sites. And some of those genes, thank you those for this question, might bind in very close areas, or sometimes they might even overlap with each other. So for example, when hunchback and bicoid are bound, they can prevent binding of giant and cripple, and other way around. So there are lots of competitive interactions here and funky dynamics going on. But most of that could be ignored for now, right?
But I guess the question is, why would you say hunchback is required for expression?
Oh, so that is an outcome of hard work of a hundred of people, literally, over 20 years,
yeah,
who were mutagenizing that region, the hell out of it, and we're doing functional analysis to understand what is actually going on here. So this is like hard evidence, as hard as it gets in biology.
So in the absence of all repressors, both hunchback, I mean, you can't read it off of this diagram, I guess.
So what I'm saying is the following. That experiments were run, like for example, imagine you take null of cripple, right? What would be your prediction? Your prediction would be that expression of if strike 2 would extend to posterior regions of the embryo. Your test that you see, right? So this is what is called hard evidence here. And all of that was done to rectify this scheme. Any more questions? Okay, let me now show you psychedelic picture. So you appreciate what is the level of resolution here. This is like how those stripes look like. And they will, I hope, to stop it at some point and make a little bit of noise about it.
What is green, what is red?
Yeah, let me just stop it when it is big enough. So gray is nuclear domain. And again, this is some of pictures that we generated in the lab. So this is hunchback expression.
Green.
Green, yeah. So there are two alleles in the nucleus for that gene, right? So at the place where it is expresses, you have multiple transcripts hanging out of the DNA. you see them as those bright spots, those are expression foci. Then at some point those transcripts dissociate from that DNA and they swim to cytoplasm. So what you see here is green and blue dots are individual transcripts, which correspond to cripple, hunchback, and giant, I believe, in this case. So sometimes, for example, you will see two dots, which means that at that instantaneous moment when we took that picture, both of those alleles were open and expressing. Sometimes you will see just one dot. Oh yeah, and it is three-dimensional picture, so it captures all of the nucleus as a Z-stack, which means that the second allele is closed at that point. It is not expressing. But this is a level of resolution that is available for modeling exercises now, right? And sometimes, for example, C, you will see expression of that hunchback in inappropriate domain. So there is noise in this system. And it would be very interesting to see how that noise is rectified by the system and the process of development to result in those very precise stripes. More questions?
What's the difference between the big dots and the small dots? The small dots is cytoplasm and big dot is expression? Or?
Yes, so that is multiple transcripts.
Uh-huh.
And single dot is a single transcript. And this technology detects not all transcripts, but about 90% of single transcripts.
Because the green dots are everywhere.
That's right. So you see broad gradient of hunchback,
okay,
as you remember, right? And stripes of blue and red on top of it. But as you also see, there is a diffusion here between nuclei, right? So they exchange information to some degree to understand how those greens, blues, and reds are going to be activated or suppressed. You have a question, no?
So green is actually a big one?
Hunchback.
Oh, hunchback, okay, sorry.
I love this picture. That was actually taken by a very funky microscope that had like 32 objectives which are observing plane from slightly different angles. And it allows to eliminate lots and lots of noise and make these structures so highly resolved that you can pretty much see individual transcripts as individual entities. That's cool, right? Not with this technology, but you could do it with us, which are called MS2 or PC7. There are technologies for that now. So, of course, if you see a picture like that, you want to describe it, right? And this is a description for just one gene A in the nucleus I. So you can label all those nucleus along single dimension from anterior to posterior. And what you now see is like simplified version of the same picture with a couple of expression foci. You don't see individual transcripts here, but trust me, they are there if you look at it closely enough. And as I mentioned, you can multiplex it. So that is expression level of a gene I in the nucleus I along anterior posterior. And you predict changes in expression level of a gene as a result of maximum expression rate that this gene could have. At transcript level, level stands for is denoted by subtitle U. At a time T, then there is decay of those transcripts when they are eaten. Then there is diffusion of those transcripts to more posterior and to more anterior, which is indicated by I minus 1, I plus 1, which depends on the stage of development of embryo, so on the number of nuclei in that embryo, because the distance between them would be different. And then from those transcripts, proteins are produced. And you can write similar equations for protein concentrations, except you need to incorporate delay time from when transcript is produced till it is translated, right? So that is something which is written for single gene. Then, of course, those patterns result not from single genes, but they result from gene regulatory networks, which are somewhat similar to what I was showing you before. This is one hypothesis about how this gene regulatory network should look like and how the genes are signaling to each other with those time delays to result in development.
So, if I understand correctly, so interestingly, you have information on sort of where mRNA is.
That's right.
And where it is produced.
That's right. Absolutely.
So that's what I was staring in those pictures. So you see green foci in some region, but then you see lots of green dots.
Absolutely.
Far away where actually they're running.
Absolutely.
And of course, there are no.
So in principle, you can decouple the rate of production, right? And this is, thanks for pointing my attention to this term, because I kind of glossed over it. So this is maximal rate of expression. And this is probability that your regulatory region is open. And this regulatory region open is depicted by the presence of this green dot, for example, for hunchback, right? And if you only see one green dot, it means that the second is absent. So for the second allele, it is closed, right? So in principle, you can decouple them. And you can devise models which are very, very funky and very interesting, including like moving to more stochastic realm, which is something of very much interest to me at present. But here we have done a little bit of cheating, because you can go infinitely complex with those, right? So the function, this function E, describes the probability of transcriptional activation of a gene A in a nucleus I at a time t given experimental concentration of transcription factors. And this is what we do. We don't try to estimate concentrations of proteins when we feed it here. We take them from data, because there is just too much noise in the model. We try to do it in the other way, and I'm about to submit it, but predictions are actually going worse. So we don't capture, when we are trying to do those estimates, we are not trying to capture full dynamic range. It's just too much, right? A little bit. But might be it is good reality check. Questions, comments, concerns?
Is that proteins?
V is proteins, and U are transcripts.
So this is all inside, like it's RNA inside the nucleus, according to the picture on the top right.
That is correct.
In the last picture, we have a lot.
Well, see, when that diffusion is, what matters, it is how much protein you have close to transcription factor.
Yes.
Close to binding site, right? And that is depicted through those diffusion coefficients, because in the nucleus or in proximity of the nucleus, you will have certain concentration of transcripts and proteins. And it could be coming from this nucleus or from nearby nuclei, right? And then they will ultimately go to the nucleus. But that procedure of transport from and to nucleus is ignored here. And this is by intent, and this stage of development is chosen by intent, because this is syncytial state, when there are no individual cells. So diffusion can be approximated reasonably well.
And we can assume that the concentration between nuclei is good, well approximated by, we can Well, otherwise that wouldn't work, right?
So that is all excellent questions, right? For now, think about as a toy, right?
Yeah.
Let's see where this toy will take us and whether or not you can accept conclusions. So, okay. Now we need to understand how to model those E guys, which is probability that promoter is open given transcript levels and protein levels. And I will not bore you with formulas, but what is happening here, it is that every cis-regulatory module is complex. This is cis-regulatory module just for one stripe for one of those genes. Imagine that you try to model all of those stripes. So there are lots of cis-regulatory modules and lots of binding sites, including that is complex regulatory region. So some configurations of binding and unbinding will result in open region, and some will result in closed, and there are multiple of each of those kinds. So to understand what is going on here, you can then enumerate all of those potential configurations, right? You can define the probability given concentration of transcription factors, and you can then count which of them will result in closed or open state, and that gives you a prediction of that E. So it is very complex machinery here, and there are lots and lots of formulas and lots of parameters here, and overall it is not identifiable with experimental data. So think about as about toy. But let's try to understand whether or not this tool is helpful to us. So what we do? All of that, which I showed you, is a result of work of multiple groups, in like represented in dozens of papers. And we come here at this stage, and we're asking the following question. See, we now, if we have sequence-based model, and we have now our sequences, we can try to understand what sequence variation superimposed on that model could predict us in terms of phenotype. Make sense? So what we have? We have reference genome. For that reference genome, there are those exquisite models, which will fit to lots of wild types, lots of expression data, lots of mutants, etc. Let's now sprinkle SNPs onto that model, try to see how those probabilities of binding are affected, and try to see how expression profiles are perturbed as a result of that. So this is kind of what we tried to do here. And we want to see mechanisms of action by individual SNPs, mechanisms of action by combined SNPs, because there might be interaction between them, and whether or not we can see signatures of purifying selection given our process-based model.
Sorry, I don't get it. So I can understand that you want to sprinkle mutations on, so you take natural variants or whatever, but how do you know what is the consequence of these ones?
So, suppose I have indel which kills that site. I now rerun my model with that site killed.
Yeah, but this is too simplistic, because it has well been shown that you can do this, and then suddenly a new site that's not as good is then being used that hasn't been used before.
Let us see what is happening here, okay?
Okay.
So this is what we are doing. And so we have multiple controls here. So we have our transcription factor binding sites into which we sprinkle that variation, and we make our prediction. And we have a group of neutral sites, which are, if you wish, controlled. And what those neutral sites are coming from? Through multiple rounds of revision of that paper, reviewers imagined all possible ways for control for neutral sites, which could be transcription factor binding sites which are closed at this developmental stage, right, with matched nucleotide composition. It could be stretches of DNA close by to transcription factor binding sites with exactly the same composition of nucleotides in them. And you can envision gazillion of different ways, right? So just let me give you a little bit of hint of comparison between what we truly see as population SNPs in through this panel of 213 genotypes. And we are working with rather few SNPs. It is only 90 SNPs here. So this is a frequency distribution, right? And between those different groups of control or neutral SNPs. And you can see, hopefully, some hint that might be selection is doing something here, because the distribution of true SNPs segregating in population is shifted towards smaller numbers. But this is just a hint, not a formal test. But it gives me a little bit of hope, at least to move forward. So, but let me show you what phenotypic data we produce, and for you to evaluate whether or not it is all sensible or not sensible. Again, see, we are taking very different paths here. So we don't really know what is going to happen, and is it going to work or not work, right? It's just like a visionary exercise, I guess, or imaginary exercise. So those green guys are actual data for expression profiles. Now, red curve is what the best fit model produced for those four genes of foci, of focus.
So you have expression data for all of the Triodium McKay?
No. For reference genotype. This is what model is fit for. Mm-hmm. So that is red. And black is our predictions of how expression profiles will look in natural genotypes.
What is data?
It's not data, it is prediction.
We label data.
This is data that we obtained on reference genotype, to which model was actually fit.
I don't get it. What's the difference between the red and the green?
Green is actual data to which model is fit. And red is what model produces as the best fit to that data for all four genes. You have your humongous model. You are trying to fit it. It produces some solutions. In fact, it produces lots of similar solutions. But those solutions result in those profiles, in those red profiles. And black, it is when we modify it in accordance with actual SNPs segregating in population.
Sorry, all I see is that your prediction doesn't match the data.
Excellent. You mean for black guys or for blue or for red guys?
Well, the red one doesn't fit the green one.
Well, it does kinda, right?
Well, the last one's a hunchback. I'm not so convinced.
Well, I'm glad that you are not so convinced. Again, those are best fits that we obtained by large groups of people trying to fit the data with models.
The difference that I see between the data and your predictions is bigger than the influence of the mutations.
Well, the question is, will it still be helpful? And you might be convinced, not convinced, but let me show you what it is, okay? So, we also have, so this is component of snapshot at certain time point. Let me now observe it through time and observe how those black guys deviate from red guys. Again, red, it is what model was built on, and black are modifications of those models on the base of segregating SNPs. So this is how this time those effects look like, which make solution, which make variation, which makes model with variant sites differ from the model for reference genotype. So what you see here, it is that sometimes you pretty much don't see effects of SNPs, sometimes you see strong effects of SNPs. And what is also interesting to note, it is that the effects of SNPs might vary between times and positions, either in sign or in magnitude. This is kind of a picture. And I plotted this picture specifically for Christian to look here and see whether or not deviation of those blacks in comparison with reds are convincing, given deviation of red in comparison with green.
This is still prediction of the model?
Yes. Black and red is prediction of the model.
But the blue and red is the difference in the predictions between the black and red lines over time.
That's correct, yeah. Across space and time.
But can you have the green one there as well, that I get an idea about?
Well, green one is experimental data.
Yeah, so but you don't have the experimental data over time.
Well, you can mentally extract a misfit between red and green in those pictures, and it will not change. It would be just a constant, right?
Why? Why is it only a constant?
Well, might be, yeah, might be it is not a constant. Might be it would change with time as well. We should do it. Okay. More questions, comments, concerns?
Individual genotypes are SNPs from?
From Raleigh resequenced lines.
Yeah.
In this particular case. Okay. So we have.
Sorry, just quick. So these SNPs, you actually. What do you know? Do you know what they do?
They segregate a natural population. Nobody else knows what they do.
In your network. In your network.
Well, we know that they affect those binding sites, right? This is why we focused on those 90 SNPs, because we know that they hit those binding sites for multiple genes, right? So by hitting those binding sites, they change how the model functions, and this is what we see phenotypic outcome of.
Yeah, but you were explaining your thing for a deletion, so and now you talk about SNPs, and I would say that the effect of SNPs on binding sites is very different from a complete deletion.
Okay, I was making.
For long, I think you literally just try to sketch exactly the influence
right.
of SNPs.
So what we look at the change of PVM score in every binding sites as a result of variant segregating in population. Okay.
Which scores are
position weight matrix. Okay. Right. So that you have seen. Let's now look at more fun pictures, I guess, or less fun. So we know which binding sites are activating and which binding sites are repressors, as I showed you in the figure. So then what we do, we look at those SNPs, and we see what those SNPs, natural SNPs, are doing in the model. Are they responsible for repression of the gene in which they take place, or for activation? So those SNPs are in activating SNPs in activating binding sites. And that is the number of those SNPs in activating sites, which are repressing the genes. And this is the number of SNPs in activating sites which are suppressing the gene. Not clear?
No.
So you have those binding sites are activating. That binding site is suppressing, right? So you know SNP here, and you predict from the model what that SNP is going to do. Is it going to activate or repress?
They're going to switch it from being an activator to a repressor.
So
what is only on the position, whether it is in the binding site of a repressor.
That is correct, yeah. So those SNPs which segregate in activating sites most frequently suppress genes, which makes sense. Those SNPs which are in suppressing binding sites, they mostly activate the genes.
But again, so let's go to the other ones that go to the effect. So you're saying that the binding transcription factor binding site is not optimal in your reference sequence, and so you could have another natural variant that makes the binding of...
Absolutely. And I will go there in the second part of the presentation. For now, bear with me, okay? So, and those binding sites where SNPs have altering effects across space or time. And you see that they're not enriched for those categories. So that is a little bit comforting. Let's now look at detection of signatures of purifying selection. So this is frequency distributions, and what is happening here? This is SNP density, frequency distribution of SNP density for those different types of neutral sites that reviewers wanted to have, and there are a bunch of them. Let us speak about it at certain, at different time point, except one of them is sticking out, which is non-model transcription factor binding site. This is something that we know is closed. It is transcription factor binding site, but it doesn't work at this developmental stage. So you have all those neutral sites. Those guys are behaving differently than neutral sites might be. But what is important for us, it is that model transcription factor binding sites, which are actually a part of that model and working at this developmental stage, they have much fewer SNPs than we would expect. So that is a sign of purifying selection. Now, what is else very interesting? It is now, let us look not at the frequencies of those sites, but let us look what those sites are doing to phenotypes. And we are going to do it in two different ways. First way, we will throw the SNP individually, and we will see its effect on phenotype, the distribution of phenotype scores. So that is control SNPs in red, which are not expected to have an effect. This is SNPs which segregate in Raleigh population in black, and they don't look different from each other. But now, I will throw those effects, those SNPs in, not individually, but I will throw them in exactly those combinations I see them in nature. Right? I will simulate not individual SNPs, but I will simulate genotypes. And now I see a huge effect. This is that black guys, which deviate from red guys quite profoundly. So it is composite action of those SNPs.
Red now is like just some random set of SNPs.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Outside of those functional transcription factor binding sites.
And you chose like the same magnitude of
we controlled set. All we could imagine, right, in all different ways.
Then you have strong epistasis.
They might be from epistasis, but let's look. It looks very funny. That picture is difficult to interpret. Let me show you a picture which is a little bit easier to interpret in my mind at least. So, red is experimental SNPs in terms of how much deviation they cause in phenotype, given the number of SNPs in a given genotype. So we have 90 SNPs, and population segregates for them. So some genotypes in Trudy's set have the few number of SNPs in accordance with reference, but some have multiple. So red are point estimates of deviation of phenotype from that reference expectation. Now, when we show random SNPs, or when and those are coming from the SNPs that we simulated in functional binding sites. So what we do, we take mutations and we mutagenize binding sites at random, and we see what phenotypic effects it is causing. So each of those simulations is about 1,000 genotypes, into which SNPs, same number of SNPs, were thrown at random at binding sites. Now what we see, that deviations, simulated deviations, are much bigger than deviations that we see among Rayleigh genotypes. So that was a comparison with neutral expectation, and that is a comparison with functional expectation. So I dare say that it is a sign of purifying selection, because we know that Rayleigh genotypes deviate much less than random set of functional SNPs matched in their characteristics that we throw on the model.
Are you going to take those pretty psychedelic pictures with any of these other strains?
Thank you very much, Tom, for asking it. This is proposal pending to NIH, because it is non-trivial to get those pictures for multiple number of genotypes and with resolution, because here our perturbations are reasonably small. They involve like couple of cells left and right, and quantitative levels of expression. And this is precisely why we spend so much time getting truly quantitative images, to then be able to use our predictions to verify them.
Well, I would say very provocatively, you would get nowhere with this if you test the DGRP lines, because we know that most of the expression is controlled intraspecifically by trans effects, not by cis effects, and you're only modeling the cis effect. So if you do this, all your signal that you will be getting comes mainly from the trans effects that are not included in your model. So what you need to do is to do CRISPR-Cas them, put this there, and then you can have it in the same genetic background if you want to test.
I would be slightly more enthusiastic from that in comparison with that, because we see that SNPs are underrepresented. And we know that when we throw a random set of functional SNPs, the model prediction deviates much more than we see with natural genotypes.
I guess the problem, though, that the Christian highlights is, let's say that you do see a difference.
Yeah.
How do you interpret it? And it seems like it would be difficult to rule out the hypothesis that it's not the other 2 million SNPs in the DV that are different in the genome, as opposed to the 4 that you're looking at in these findings.
Well, I agree with you, Patrick and Christian, because we don't know what we don't know. But we here have started from the model which is working at the early stages of development, in which very few genes matter. And there are lots of mutational screens which people have done at this developmental stage, and for maternal genes. And this is what they rectified as genes that matter. Doesn't mean that we can ignore the rest, but at least it gives us some assurance that if we are to understand something in model-based way, this is the right place to look for that.
Yeah, I don't.
But still,
I agree with that.
Hunchback is regulated as well.
Huh?
Hunchback, Krippe, whatever, Knirps, whatever, they're all regulated as well, and you're not controlling for this.
Christian, this is a start of some potential experimental program. Sure, we can approach this problem by modifying trans effects of genes on each other, right? How I show it you with, like, structural equation models, right? We can dig it from multiple angles. What I'm showing you first steps of trying to do it, okay?
By making an F1s, you'll be able to separate cis and trans effects.
Well, that is a little bit difficult in this particular case, because most of those transcripts, for example, Hunchback, it is before zygotic transition, right? So it is coming from mom. So it is a little bit more complex than that, but in principle, it is a good point.
Actually, it's sort of interesting because you can have maternal transcripts against the
absolutely
the right. Yeah, the cis sites would be from the from the individual.
Okay, so, and now
okay, I have a question. Can you tell us again, or tell me again, what do you conclude from this?
Okay, so I look at through this line with 10 mutations in those binding sites. I see that phenotype deviates from the best model by this amount, right? Then I take 10 random functional sites that could be functional in those binding sites.
What do you conclude?
I conclude that average set of 10 SNPs, functional SNPs, would cause much bigger deviation than what I see in nature.
What do you conclude from that?
Purifying selection.
Isn't that like I would somehow conclude, for example, that there's some form of canalization going on?
Might be those combinations of SNPs cancel each other, but this would be a form of purifying selection, which makes those genes sitting together, which in combination don't cause much of phenotypic deviation.
Canalization would work on the phenotype, not
on the genotype. That's right, yeah.
And all that's been modeled here is the genotype.
Yeah, you can think about it as a sign of canalization or whatever. And sincerely, the most difficult part for me here is the following. I know
canalization can work on the expression.
I know there are 50 different definitions of canalization models.
Okay, so
anyway,
what is most difficult for me to accept in this work, sincerely, it is that the model which describes all that glory is unidentifiable. It has multiple aqueous solutions. And we have worked here with single best solution. I am sure, or solutions that we like, I am sure that it would be roughly similar in terms of perturbation properties. We have taken assemblage of those solutions. But this is something to be tested. Mm-hmm.
I got a little lost along the way. Multiple times, I'm afraid. So you really want to inject some systems biology into population genetics?
I want to build on the systems biology.
And there are so two ways of doing it. One can say, well, we're going to dissect these binding sites and cooperativity of transcription factors that bind by whatever, directed mutagenesis, biochemistry, whatever, throw all the molecular genetics at it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or you may say, well, what can we learn about underlying systems biology from observing the effect of SNPs in...
My logic is very different from that. My logic is the following.
Hold on, yeah. Still try to tighten my question a little bit. But now going back to this nonlinearity business, in your model, what exactly was assumed about cooperativity in the action of these transcription factors?
That is an excellent question, and let's discuss it separately from this room, because there are lots of cooperative terms involved in the model to make it fit best.
It's known that they are cooperative.
Yes, right? And it is a part of the model. And I am not...
So it is a part of the model.
Of course, yeah. Right. And you can read all of those papers that were published on that model to make it maximally feasible from the standpoint of developmental biology. Cooperativity, non-linearity of interactions, it's all there. We just use the following logic. We assume that those molecular biologists or developmental biologists didn't spend their time for nothing, that they actually understood something, that they understand how the system works. But the idea of how the system works is platonic. It is the idea of like ideal car which is running some place on the sky, and all those cars which we see around it is imperfect materialization of that, right? So what we assume here, we have that idealistic grand model of how it works in ideal perfect setting. Let's try now to genotype that model and modify this model in genotype specific way and see what we come up with. And we can do it because this is sequence-based model. There are a few sequence-based models. This is one of them. There is another one for eye development. And there is another one for blood type development in humans. But that is it in whole realm of developmental biology now.
Well, sorry. I don't understand. So how are we interpreting the collective behavior of those SNPs? Are they additive?
No, they are not additive.
So, but you already know that they're not additive because you've done your biochemistry.
This is not correct.
Biology.
This is not correct. If you dissect any quantitative trait with quantitative genetics, you will see that overwhelming amount of variation is contributed by genes with non-additive action, but it translates into predominantly additive variation segregated in population. So the fact that model is not additive or non-linear doesn't imply that effect of small deviations will be not additive either.
I don't disagree with that.
Okay. Let me move on, because...
What have we learned about either population genetics or systems biology from this?
Well, I learned the following point.
Assumptions that are used to interpret the data.
I learned the following points. I learned the points that SNPs in transcription factor binding sites are important, that they can upregulate or suppress the genes, which is a topic a little bit debated in molecular evolutionary biology. I learned how they do it, in terms of how they cause deviation in phenotypes, and do they do it independently from each other, or do they do it as conglomerates. I learned that those SNPs which are segregating in natural populations are perturbing phenotypes less than a random set of SNPs in transcription factor binding sites. And sincerely, for me, those are interesting conclusions. I don't know for you folks, but I didn't know that. Okay. Let me now very briefly, like over 5 minutes, to introduce you another little topic, and then I will let Chris speak for another 10 minutes about even more provocative line of research, okay? So we know our regulatory sequences. It is 18 KB. So we decided to simulate evolution of those guys. We just wanted to throw random mutations on them. We wanted to implement predefined selection, like in experimental evolution scenario. And we wanted to see what happens. So we simulated a population of 100 haploid individuals, and all of those predictions are homozygous prediction and models. We select 20 best individuals which are allowed to reproduce, and we run it for 3,350 generations, seeing what is happening with the number of binding sites and with the distribution of their intensities. So this is what we see. We see that strong effect on binding is not the same as strong fitness effect. It's not the same as strong perturbation on phenotypes. Turns out that weak binding sites, but in the right place in the model, might be much more meaningful for fitness effect than strong binding sites, but which don't move your phenotype too much out of your desirable space. This is observed through general lack of correlation between the strengths of binding and effect on phenotype. You can see lots of scatter here in this picture. We see that what model does when we evolve it? It evolves except for one gene, HKB, that has very few binding sites in the model, that it evolves strongly smaller number of binding sites. Lots of binding sites disappear. They don't seem to be meaningful. And so this is binding energy of those sites which remain in the model from original set of sites in comparison with those which disappeared. But there are new sites rising as well. This is towards to Christian's question. we observe arising of new binding sites, which we see by appearance of position weight matrix. And what is surprising is that although those binding sites are, most of them are weak, they survive for much longer in population despite being hit by mutations. Don't know why it is happening. So what else we see? So that is evolution of mean energy of binding. And this is evolution of proportion of strong binding sites, ratio of weak binding sites to strong binding sites. We start from off the model with large number of reasonably weak sites, and then it evolves under mutation, high mutation pressure, presumably, where lots of sites disappear. But those sites that survive enable okay functioning of the model.
I don't think I understand that. Because the strength of the binding site, ultimately what's important is your phenotype is always judged by whether the transcription factor is bound or not bound.
Not correct. It is judged by how expression level of a gene deviates from experimental data.
Correct.
And strength of binding doesn't translate to that deviation of phenotype one to one. And how it translates, for that we need to have a model.
I completely agree, but I also don't entirely understand the sweeping conclusion, right? So for example, there are some transcription factors which respond to very low level of B-Corp, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're out there closer to the tail, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
So phenotypically, they can be just every bit as important, or maybe even more, because in the tail, that's where germ cells are.
I completely agree with your statement. I just want to move from your verbal statement to model-based conclusion. And this is what this exercise is about. Because if you read hundreds of developmental biology papers, they all are filled with verbal conclusions, which are very difficult to validate because there is no model associated with them. So finally, this is a distribution of lifetime of different binding sites. And what you see, it is that most of binding sites are short-living. But there is surprisingly a group of binding sites which is old-living and which is always present, no matter what we do with simulations. And I guess I will kind of leave that picture for later for questions. So what is so special about those guys? Turns out that those binding sites which survive for a long, long time, those are binding sites which have overlaps by multiple binding sites. So presumably they're just, when they incur mutations, it is breaking the system in multiple ways. And this is why they're selected out. So this is a proportion of frequency of overlapping binding sites dependent on their survival time. So that pink stuff means that the proportion of those overlapping binding sites among long surviving is much longer. So in any case, there are lots and lots of limitations of that approach, and we are just trying to understand how to use it. So all of those questions and concerns are super helpful because nobody has tried to do it before. So, and we clearly need to do a couple of changes. For example, replace protein concentrations from given to calculated, and might be think about developing model from deterministic to replace it with stochastic, because all those binding sites are necessary, and probably lots of them are necessary to reduce stochasticity, because it is quite damaging. But this is our current state, and to eliminate further questions from Boris, I will put on this figure, because it will captivate your attention so much.
Yes.
Okay. So that's it, I guess. So more questions, comments, concerns.
So since a bunch of those transcription factors get lost in the simulation, have you? I mean, they don't in reality.
Well, our simulation was kind of yucky because population size 100, 20 survivals. You only keep what is super important,
still,
right?
It's a common thing when you model things like this that you find that, you know, like why are so many genes not essential, stuff mm-hmm. like that, right? You find
right,
that,
yeah.
that your what your conception of the target of fitness mm-hmm. is usually is very narrow.
Well, you know, my kind of, I will give very indirect hunch for that, for answering that. And the hunch would be when Trisha Witkop recently, in her recent experiments, we are trying to produce new mutations and compare the properties of new mutations in transcription factor binding sites with segregating mutations. What she figured out, it is that mean effect on expression level was no different between segregating and induced. But there was severe difference in how stochastic they were. So those which were introduced as new mutations, just were making genes expressing in very irregular ways. And that is a deterministic model. It combines thermodynamic component and ODU. And I would really love to move to stochastic realm with it, but might be it will become overwhelmingly complex. I'm not sure it would be a productive way of going.
Doesn't it also mean that there are unmeasured environmental variables? So it doesn't have to be stochastic.
Absolutely, yeah, 100%.
Yeah, I mean, I guess a lot of the belief about what these transcription networks are doing is mm-hmm. dealing with things that you aren't necessarily measuring in the lab or thinking about. Yeah.
Granted, absolutely. Okay, thank you very much another time, and I really hope for your feedback in the future. But meanwhile, if you don't mind, I would like to switch to 10 minutes of Chris.